Inoho, please be seated.
Thank you, Your Honour. Now, before the adjournment, we were exploring the efficiency and effectiveness of the option recommended by the planners who participated in the joint witness conferencing. I'd now like to explore the same subject matter with the technical witnesses who participated in the joint witness conferencing. And I have my eyes on paragraph 3 of the joint witness conference, where Ms. King and Mr. Wilson and Mr. Leslie consider that option 1A is more efficient and effective. And just for the record, option 1A is the option which simply results in the rights of priority ceasing to have effect on 1 October 2021. So in a similar way to the way I explored it with the planners, I'd like first to understand what the technical witnesses had in mind when they were thinking about the efficiency of the options and how that informed the recommendation that option 1A was more efficient.
Simon Wilson, I guess focusing on efficiency, and Ms. King can speak from a consenting perspective, but from a compliance and enforcement perspective, we didn't consider that option 1B would be efficient. So it wouldn't be easy to implement.
Alexandra King. So from a consenting perspective, it's I considered it more efficient to not include priorities because it's less information that both the applicant has to supply and the council then has to consider.
Mr. Leslie, anything different?
Sean Leslie, not really.
So the efficiency consideration was really one about the extra steps that would need to be taken both by consent applicants in preparing their applications, but also with respect to the council in processing those applications, and then perhaps a third limb, the enforcement, the extra enforcement that may arise.
Simon Wilson, and potentially, depending on what the clauses read, the extra steps that the consent holders would have to jump through in order to enable that enforcement.
Okay, if we move on to effectiveness, what is it that you had in mind when you were thinking about the effectiveness of the provisions?
Simon Wilson, so for me, it was more that I've yet to be convinced that option B would be effective at continuing the effects of the current priorities.
Alexandra King, and I agree, and in terms of effectively transitioning these permits for a short term, I, in my opinion, it's more effective that the priorities weren't included.
And when you were thinking about effectiveness, did you have in mind the incidental environmental benefits that may accrue with the priorities coming down?
Simon Wilson, I guess my take on it is that I'm not sure, and we discuss it further in the document, but whatever we put in place to replicate priorities may not necessarily replicate the effect of the priorities as they stand today. There will be some permits that have priorities that have already been renewed and therefore drop out of the chain. There will be others that aren't being renewed. There may be some that currently collectively hold a priority which are then split up so it's easier for them to exercise. So I'm not convinced that, and it's getting outside my area of expertise, but I'm not convinced that you will replicate the same effects as the current priorities give you.
Now, before we move on from the efficiency and effectiveness assessment, you have included quite helpfully in the joint witness statement at Appendix 1A, Section 32AA, analysis of the various options. And there was one part that caught my eye in that assessment, and I'm on the first page of the appendix, and I'm looking at option 2, which is the option that has been recommended by the planners, And in the box on the right-hand side there, there's reference to the risk of acting or not acting and sufficiency of information. And there's reference there to, well, there's a statement that there is sufficient information available to understand the importance of priority rights in some catchments. And it was the reference to some catchments that caught my eyes there. And I was interested to understand what information you were thinking about when you were thinking about, or used the phrase, some catchments. So how widespread in your mind is the issue that you're trying to address by the option that you've recommended?
Tom de Polsmacher. I think that's the issue that we've been grappling with all along since we started this discussion, is that we have evidence that priorities are being exercised. We have evidence that in catchments or on water bodies where there are deemed permits with priorities, there are also galexits. But they're like snapshots, really. We don't have a whole overview of how widespread the problem is. Because it's a risk that we can't quantify, I tried to quantify it, but it's really hard to do it. I think we cannot act given the significance of the values that are involved. I personally have tried to kind of, confine the scope, geographical scope of this. And also, I think in light of the concerns raised by my ORC colleagues as well, I think it's probably something that we need to keep alive. In the past, I talked to Ms. Dicey and Ms. McKeek as well, trying to actually identify the catchments or the water bodies where priorities effectively being exercised. But that is a very hard exercise, it is without contacting every single deemed permit holder individually, you can't really speak on their behalf. It's a subjective matter. More recently, actually, over the weekend and on Friday, I tried to explore another avenue, which is to identify the catchments where galexits might be or where there is a high likelihood of them being. And I have to say, we've heard previous evidence at the start of the hearing that our knowledge as to where they are occurring, their specific distribution, is not 100% complete. So we have a general feeling based on Dr. Alabone's evidence. He indicated we have a general idea of their distribution, where exactly in water bodies they are. We don't know that everywhere. But I think if that is definitely something that is worthwhile exploring. I actually talked to a freshwater ecologist at the ORC last week and asked him to assist me with a process of eliminating. I've got to take my notes, but we did actually make a list of all the catchments in the Clutha FMU and the Taree FMU, which are the key ones where you have priorities and where you have galexits. Now, there are also some priorities, my understanding, in North Otago, and there might be some galexits there as well. But what we managed to do there was actually narrow down the number of water bodies quite significantly. Just to give you a bit of an idea, and again, those numbers are very preliminary. When we look at the number of water bodies and catchments in those two FMUs that have surface water takes on them, we've got approximately 500 water bodies divided over nearly 60 catchments. When we eliminated the ones where galexits do not exist or are unlikely to exist, so we only keep the ones where galaxies have been recorded or where there is a potential that they'll be. And also we eliminated the catchments like the Lindus and I believe the Luggett as well, where the deemed permits have already been, they are still current, but the replacement consents are in place. Then we arrived at a list of 88 water bodies and, again, approximately a dozen catchments. So it narrows it down significantly. I think there is opportunity to narrow it down even further by eliminating catchments where there are deemed permits, but none of the deemed permits have priorities, or where there's only one deemed permit with a priority left. And that is not an inconceivable scenario, because a lot of those little water bodies only have two or three maximum deemed permits on them. Also, must say that we had very limited time. We didn't get through the Tyree catchment as well, so we might be able to eliminate a number of other water bodies in that FMU. That helps us to identify where priorities can be carried over in order to safeguard in-stream values. I acknowledge that it's not a full response to the problem, because in a number of catchments, the benefit of having priorities is more focused on a water user outcome and keeping the reliability of supply.
In terms of the other planners and perhaps the technical witnesses, is there anything that you'd like to add in terms of reference to the some catchments, as that phrase is used in the table?
Murray Brass, and I would agree with Mr. Pelsmaker that there will be some catchments where the issue doesn't arise. But for me, the key thing was that there is sufficient information to understand that there is an issue in at least some catchments where the loss of priorities without some replication could lead to loss of quite significant values, which I guess sort of lead into the other part of that assessment there, is that there is a risk of not acting if priorities are not replicated or managed in some way. There are values that would be at risk as a result.
Sally Dicey. I agree with Mr. Brass's comments. In addition, in terms of the sum catchments, one of the key ones that we heard quite a bit of evidence about, I think, was the Manuherikia. And that related not just in terms of loss of indigenous species values, but also water user access to water and the potential to upset the status quo of sorts within that catchment. And that, of course, affects a large number of water users. I would have concerns about potentially eliminating some or only focusing on catchments with galaxids, potentially because we don't necessarily always have the information about where those populations are, but also that doesn't address the water user access component of the priority system.
Just briefly comment on the sum. For me, that was a recognition that we couldn't put all in that statement. We didn't have a level of understanding about the environment to say all. We understood that there was enough of an issue to address it, and Mr. Brass has touched on that, but that's why sum was used in my mind.
Okay, I'm going to move on now to the provisions that have been recommended, and to do that I thought we might usefully start with the addition that's been recommended to policy 10A 2.1. It's helpfully highlighted with blue shading within the joint witness statement. And the question that I have in mind is relating to the use of the word effect within that policy. The policy recommended starts with the effect of any deemed permit right of priority. And I'm interested to understand what you had in mind when you were using the word effect in that context.
Tom de Pelsmacher, the effect on the flow regime.
My RAS, that would be my view as well.
Mr. de Pelsmacher, what was your response to that? Question is, what is the meaning of the effect of the word effect? And your answer was?
It's the effect on the flow regime.
Oh, effect on the flow
regime. Yes, sorry.
Just pause there a second. I just now want to reread the policy with that in mind. So, in effect, the effect on the flow regime of any deemed permit. That's how we're to understand that policy? I've just interpolated their policy to read in flow regime.
The effect on the flow regime that was created by the exercise of deemed permits. Sorry, the exercise of rights of priority.
Yep. All right.
I've got a follow-on question, but you might want to go along in terms of this policy. I could put it out there and then you could decide whether it's the right time to ask it. I guess the question I have is the policy talks about the priority regime existing at 18 March 2020, and I was having some difficulty with that date, particularly when I looked at what you had in the rules.
I would think it's fair to say that there are a lot of words in there that we need to tease out. So I think we should hear your examination and then see if we eliminate some of our questions, because I think we've got questions perhaps on a number of the phrases and words used, trying to understand what you're meaning here. Yeah.
Some of them have been highlighted, including that date, so I intend to explore that.
Ignore the date and just think about this. Policy and principle.
So starting with, and we were exploring what the effect that you had in mind was, and my understanding is it's the effect of the priority regime on the flow regime. Does anybody, Ms. Dicey?
Sally Dicey. That wording I think also partly reflected a response from us to concerns raised about the fact, and Dr. Somerville's legal opinion, that the rights of priority will finally expire, and so we're not just assuming that they're carrying forward. So to me it was also recognising that what once existed no longer existed, but Plan Change 7 is trying to replicate that and the effect of that. And to me, it actually goes further than just the flow regime, because it's about access to water as well. So they're interlinked, of course. Yeah.
Just to tease out then a little further in your mind, the effect of the priority regime could be a very broad matter, whereas if it's the effect whether it's the effect of that regime on the flows within stream, that's a more narrow subset of what the priority regime in its current form achieves.
I wouldn't say what I suggested was very broad. It's still around the continuing theme that we've talked about all the way through with priorities was really twofold: access to water and the incidental environmental effects of that.
Perhaps I'll put my question a little differently. You weren't intending to bring down the current way by which the priority regime is implemented. That wasn't one of the effects you were thinking about when you used the word effect.
No.
Now, I have highlighted the date, the 18th of March 2020, and I was interested in the effect of using that date in the context of the way in which the rules work, and in particular the way in which the definition is framed up in terms of reference to the date one day prior to expiry. So perhaps the first question is, why is the date 18 March 2020 used in the policy?
The intent there was to make sure that where priorities have been abandoned through replacement of resource consent, to not revive them. So make sure that where priorities exist at the moment, that that effect is being carried over. So it doesn't work retrospectively.
Murray Brass, there's also one other element, which is that some of the applications which are currently in play may well not be resolved until after the existing deemed permits have expired and the right of priority associated with that has then extinguished. So this was to create a point in time at which we could, if you like, as an accounting exercise, say this was the right of priority that existed at that point in time, and that's therefore what is to be recreated on the replacement consent.
Is there a disconnect then when you look at the definition of right of priority and reference there to the date of the 30th of September 2021?
The intention there, as I said, Murray Brass, was those dates are based on the final expiry as set in the Act. So it is ensure that the definition remains relevant post that particular date. So that's about that recognition, but for accounting purposes, if you like, suggesting the date of notification of the plan in terms of when priorities would be assessed from.
Was there a second? I've now caught up with the purpose of the question. And and you're referring to the line, the two lines following subclause D, aren't you? And from the 1st of October includes priority right that was still in force on the 30th September 2021? Correct. Okay, so is there a disconnect from the 18th of March with the two dates there? Now that I finally caught up, sorry about that. What was your answer again, Mr. Brush?
So in terms of the definition, it was to apply to, if you like, the existence of the right of priority. So if somebody was still going through a consent replacement process post 30 September, the definition would ensure that the right of priority still has an existence in terms of the definition, so it hasn't completely disappeared. And then with it having been maintained through the definition, the date that you set the allocation that you design your replacement condition on would be based on the date of notification of the plan. It may be possible to align those. I haven't turned my mind fully to that.
I thought your answer to the previous question by Councillor was quite clever in terms of putting the 18th of March date there, was to so that no one gets caught out, if you like, depending on which way we go on the legal issue,
yes.
No one gets caught out. So you can always look back to the 18th of March and say, yes, it's whatever those rights were as of that date. Now, I'm not sure how solid that date is, but for present purposes, it doesn't matter. If you got rid of those two lines following subparagraph D, what's the problem? It's So wherever you stand on the legal issue, whether, you know, the right falls away or doesn't fall away on the 1st of October of this year, if you can reach back in time to the 18th and say, well, if they had a priority then, that, you know, that's we need to grab that or do something in relation to that.
I think the concern there, Mayor Brass, still, was that there are references to rights of priority or the effects of rights of priority elsewhere in the various proposed changes to the plan change. So it was to ensure that for people post 30 September, that those references remain valid through the definition.
Could you take us to where you, what, could you provide us an example?
In Controlled Activity 10A311.
So Controlled Activity 10A311.
Yep. And over the page, the Council reserves control over the following matters.
Yeah.
So that's a reference to the exercise of rights of priority, which doesn't directly tie back to that date of notification of the plan. So it's ensuring that that reference there, and there may well be others, but that's the one that I can see. Oh, sorry, and similarly, the matters of discretion and the discretionary activity.
Yeah.
So it's to ensure that those references remain valid and aren't extinguished post the 30 September.
So... okay, so putting the dates aside, what you were trying, with the reference to the 18th of March 2020, what you're trying to do here is still enable a pathway through for applicants for replacement consents who have not had their application processed by the 1st of October 2020, and where the court may make a determination that those rights from that date have ceased to effect and can't be carried over under 124. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. All right, well, I'll keep that in mind. but that's quite a clever idea, but I'll keep that in mind. I'm not sure that you get there, but good. All right.
Does that have something to do with it? Because that does actually talk about, in the context of Chapter 10A, means a resource consent or deemed permit. And then it has not expired or has expired, but where the consent holder can still exercise the permit under Section 124. Because one of the entry conditions is a valid permit, isn't it?
That is correct in terms of the permit. Sorry, my brow still. But I think we're also, and it may be an abundance of caution, but allowing for the possibility that the right of priority may not automatically carry through with the deemed permit under Section 124. So if you're in a situation where the effect of legal requirements was such that you could still refer to a deemed permit under Section 124, but the right of priority had been extinguished, we wanted to sort of have that date that you could tie it back to.
So that it remains extinguished?
No, so that there is a date that you can refer to, so when you're crafting a replication of the effect of that priority, you've got even if that right of priority itself no longer exists, you can go back to a point in time and say, what was it that existed at that point in time? Now, it may be, in the normal course of event, you would simply deal with the conditions that were still in effect through Section 124, but we were wanting to cover the potential that rights of priority were not being carried over through Section 124, and referring to Dr. Somerville's views on that matter. So it may be that this is not required, depending on where that goes. That's a legal question. From a planning perspective, we wanted to ensure that that scenario was covered.
Okay, so why didn't you just make that 18th of March date a 30th of September 2021 date? In your policy. Mr. Brass, I'm asking you, why didn't you do that?
And I'm just turning my mind back, because we had quite some discussion and iterations on that.
Mm.
And I'm open to if any of the other planners
have
a better
recollection. Do you not recall what your thinking was there?
I wouldn't guarantee it, no.
Can't guarantee you to recall. Okay. All right. Tom, the Pulsemaker, do you recall?
No, I think it was just trying to capture the situation at the point of notification.
But of the plan?
Of the plan, yes.
Was it a more sensible date to have it prior to the legal issue, which hasn't been determined? But if it did come in against, and that's what you're trying to cover, why not the 30th of September? Because at least most people will look up the legislation and go, oh, yeah, I know what that's about. The 18th of March, people might be struggling to
I cannot see any drawbacks from lining up the definition, or actually lining up the policy with the definition, the data and the definition.
Mm. Mr. Enzel, do you recollect?
Nothing different in terms of the reasoning, aligning it with the date of notification. I've got a nagging suspicion that there was something else, but it doesn't seem to be. Murray might have recalled.
Murray Brass. I think part of the concern there was the converse of applications which are not resolved until post the 30th of September, is that if an application was completed and a replacement consent was being issued prior to the 30th of September, that if you refer to the 30th of September date, it doesn't work because you're not yet at that date. So if a consent was being issued in August, for example, a reference back to the date of notification of the plan would be valid. A reference to a date in the future when the existing consent will have been expired or will have been replaced, it was that concern.
All right, Ms. Dicey, have you got anything different to add?
Sally Dicey, my only addition was that from memory, and I'm not sure this was something that I raised, was that the 18th of March date was intended to kind of prevent anyone almost resurrecting a priority that had fallen by the wayside already. A consent had been replaced, the priority hadn't been replaced, but it still exists on some old document and someone tries to resurrect it.
Sorry, Mr. Moore. That captured my attention. Okay.
Yes.
I think I know where they're going.
Yes.
Quite clever.
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to explore that last point just a little bit further, because I too am interested in the gap between those dates and what the implications might be. And I'm interested to know from the technical witnesses whether deemed permits do in practice fall away or are surrendered, or whether they are actually still in existence up until the 1st of October 2021.
Sean Leslie speaking. To some extent that depends on the consent holder.
We have a number of deemed permits in our system that are still current, but they have actually been replaced by a resource consent as a status of not yet commenced, because there's a variety of reasons why that happens, including the fact that the applicant has made the choice that they would rather just let the deemed permit expire than having to deal with the paperwork of surrendering a resource consent.
Simon Wilson, having said that, though, there are a number of deemed permits which over time have been surrendered. I think around 200 from memory, but, yeah.
Now, Ms King, in terms of the types of conditions that have typically been applied to RMA permits issued in replacement of deemed permits, is there a condition requiring that before the new RMA permit is exercised, the deemed permit is surrendered?
Commonly it will say either the permit needs to have expired or surrendered. It's in one condition kind of merged. So it needs to have done either of those things for this new permit to commence.
Right, so then picking up on the point Ms Dicey was making, which was one of seeking to ensure that, and I may have misunderstood this, that you were concerned at the potential re-exercising of a permit after the 18th of March?
So it wasn't so much Sally Dicey thinking of re-exercising an expired or surrendered permit, but yeah, if that permit had been replaced whether somebody with an RMA permit, whether somebody tried to resurrect a priority when they see this hit the ground, I think it's very unlikely.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So staying with the policy, do the planners consider there would be some merit in clarifying the intent or the precise meaning of what the actual effect that is seeking to be replicated is? And we talked about the flow regime was what it was speaking to, but was there do you consider merit in actually precisely recording that?
I personally do. I think just thinking back on what Ms. Dicey said previously, I think reference to the flow regime actually captures both looking after in-stream values and providing a flow regime that gives sufficient certainty of supply, not sufficient, but the same certainty of supply as previously.
Mr. Brass.
Murray Brass, yeah, I would support that. And also, in terms of efficiency, recreating the flow regime or replicating the flow regime is a relatively straightforward matter of fact. If there are effects on people's access to water or in-stream values, then they would require quite a bit more effort to understand. So certainly my view is that the references to the flow regime, which is a straightforward matter of fact, and the other effects would then flow from that, but independently, if you like.
Ms. Dicey.
Sally Dicey. Just thinking on the hoof, really, but I'd be a little bit nervous, potentially. Referencing the flow regime, does that then open up the need for an assessment of what that flow regime was, whether there are actually Galaxids in that stream, whether they'll be affected by any change? I think it potentially creates yet more complexity. At its very simplest, replicating the effect of priorities is simply replicating the ability of one permit holder to tell another permit holder to do something. And so my preference would, you know, on the spot, probably not to go down that path.
Would your answer change if instead of a flow regime, you actually refer to what it is, which is a flow sharing regime? To me, the benefit to the environment is completely incidental, and it's also contingent on a number of other factors. So that's what it is. It's flow sharing as between abstractors. So would your views change if that's what the reference was?
Perhaps not flow sharing, because again, I think the subservient doesn't see it as sharing when they're told to simply turn off. I think the concept around sharing in the community is far more about ensuring everybody has access to some water rather than someone's got the ultimate right over somebody else. I'd be, again, a little bit cautious about that wording as well. Maybe replicating historical access to water, wording more along those lines perhaps.
When reading the policy, is there a risk that the current drafting reflects an actual regime that existed on an actual date?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
So, looking at the drafting, is there a risk that what the policy is requiring is that the flow regime that existed on a particular date is to be replicated?
Sally Dicey, again, I think I'd come back to the simplest perspective of all the effect ultimately is the ability of one person to tell another person to cut back on at any given time, depending on the flow scenario.
Hi, I'm Alexandra King. I think that there is a risk that looking at that date, you would need to go back in time and find out what priorities were existing then to know what the effect was at that date. If you're looking at it simply, you could read it that way.
Simon Wilson, just to add that in order to replicate the effect, you have to replicate it on multiple permits, so that there's dominant and the subservient. So if one of those permits has been renewed in the meantime and you can't replicate the condition on that permit, I'm not sure how you replicate the effect.
Sally, I see, and that's where the date may be helpful to the effect of the deemed permit situation existing as of 18th of March rather than as existed historically in the early 1900s.
So in light of this discussion, is there some further work necessary to be more precise about what the effect is that's coming down or to be replicated?
Tom de Palsmaker. I think in terms of the risk that the current wording would trigger risk that applicants would be required to take comprehensive assessments.
Sorry, I think applicants would be required to undertake comprehensive, was it?
Comprehensive,
yeah,
assessments.
On this, yeah.
I think that risk is fairly limited, given that you have a controlled activity and that it's fairly constrained. The benefit would be in considering applications under the non-complying pathway. It needs to be clear that the date refers to the priority regime itself and not to the effect that was occurring on that specific date. So if that's not clear, then the policy needs to be amended. Specifying which effect, I think clarity is always better, really. But I don't have any words in my mind now as to how you specifically can do it. Flow regime might be too wide.
Ms. Dicey's been thinking.
Sally Dicey. I'm not sure it would assist. I think it would almost be better to go the other way, which is the controlled for two reasons. One, the first is that it is coupled with a controlled activity pathway as the primary pathway, and so I think that in itself will keep it simple, particularly if it's coupled with a clear application form as well, which actually just suggests the condition to the applicants. The second is that it almost would be better to go simpler rather than more complicated from my perspective by taking out the word effect and using the word in the rule, which is simply to replicate the right of priority, and to leave the effect component out of it altogether.
Thinking about that a little further, if you were to replicate the current right of priority, it would include the current way in which rights of priority can be exercised and enforced.
I think the word replicate, sorry Sally Dicey, the word replicate leaves enough room for the controlled activity to create something slightly different, but in essence replicating the effect of it.
At its heart, isn't the thing that you are seeking to replicate is in fact the ability for a dominant permit holder to, say, call priority over the subservient permit holder, and everything else is incidental to that, as in the flow regime's incidental to that option or mechanism being available. The incidental, the environmental benefit is also incidental to that. So is that the key or the key element that needs to be replicated?
Sally, I see, yes.
So then when we're thinking about the policy, might the policy be crafted in such a way that it focuses very clearly that it's that element of the right of priority that is to be replicated?
Sally Dicey, yes, possibly.
Possibly. Yes or no?
Yeah. Trying to think that through on my feet.
Yeah.
And then trying to think ahead as to what the wording might be around that.
You don't actually have to write the words. all you have to do is just really reflect on Mr. Moore's questions, because they'll be the same questions from the court, which is let go of the wording of the Act, because you're kind of not reflecting what's in the Act anyway, so it's going to cause confusion, I think. And let's go to the heart of what it is that you want to achieve. So your answer, a couple of questions back to Mr. Moore was, Ms. Dicey, your answer was, I think it was you, all you want to do is be able to tell your neighbour to turn off. Okay, well, that's pretty simple. I think I can put that into planning language rather than just tell your neighbour to turn off. But if that's at the heart of it, why didn't you just say it? Why isn't that in the policy, which I think is Mr. Moore's question?
That's a fair question, and, yep. My answer would be yes to Mr. Moore's question. And it, partly to explain, our use or my use of the right of priority is, I think water users in Otago are very familiar with the right of priority wording. So I think that lay people will understand what is meant by that. So familiar words
I get the benefit of familiar words, but the potential problem that you have with that answer is that people understand rights of priority. It means I can tell my neighbour or neighbours to start reducing or to cut off, but you don't intend people to start reducing, you just intend to cut off. So already there's a disconnect between historical practices, which are well understood within Otago, and what it is that's going on in here. Now, we need to talk about the start, you know, the reducing aspect of this anyway, but so I understand the benefit of using language consistently, but this policy doesn't and you don't mean it to. So perhaps new language is required. Mr. Enzel.
Tim Enzel, look, from my understanding, the effect of any deemed permit right of priority regime was that there was only one effect, and it allowed the dominant party to give notice to a subservient party. But if there is some uneasiness about that word or the consideration that it could be interpreted in multiple ways, then I think it's worth looking at a different word.
Well, you have concern yourself, having signed up to this joint witness statement, because I understood the legal effect of a right of priority was that I could ask my neighbour to reduce or to cease. So there's two effects. Only one is contemplated by the panel of planners. So you're already in that camp of, I wonder if there could be an interpretational issue in terms of consistent usage of language and how well language is understood, you know, by the community. So you're there already.
Yeah, I see that.
Murray Brass. Part of my concern, which I think sort of led to my view in terms of using wording along the lines of the effects of rights of priority, was that to an extent a right of priority that currently exists operates as a private property right. They are expressed that way in legal terms. They are valued in when people are valuing properties. That is something that the Resource Management Act cannot create. It cannot create that sort of private property right. So it was looking to find wording which expressly pulls it into a resource management issue as opposed to a private matter.
But you see, the problem with that answer is this, that you then, in your definition, used landlord language of dominant and servant. Now, that is landlord. And so then you immediately start to bring in this idea of ownership. And, of course, I mean, one of my questions is, do we think we've got property and water now? And where does that go in terms of Section 112 or 122? I've forgotten which way.
Yeah, I guess from my point of view, that was where I was thinking the aim is to recreate the same effect in terms of the flow regimes and what that means for in-stream values and existing uses, but as a resource management activity as opposed to a private property right.
I appreciate that. I think that's probably the correct approach as well. And this isn't to pour scorn or anything on anything that you've done. This is your proposal. So for my part, I will be looking to see how to make it work. But the question is, what do you want to work? But, you know, is it reducing and ceasing, or is it just ceasing? And anyway, is the value of this tool, I mean, it will be valuable for some people, but is the value of the tool is that it actually sets up the flow sharing regime. Anyway, that is the private agreement, and that's the value. Sorry. Plain speaking is, I think, use plain language is what I'd encourage, yeah.
So just staying with the policy for one further question of clarification. Have I understood correctly that the planners are not intending that the current enforcement mechanism relating to priorities is to be brought down. So at the moment there's a mechanism where a user has to head off to the High Court to seek relief if the regime or if the notice is not given effect to. I'm assuming that that's not an effect that you had in mind to be replicated. But can you perhaps clarify that?
Correct, that's correct. Tom the pulse marker.
I couldn't understand, actually, just by the by, there's a legal issue there, because I couldn't understand why the evidence was that you'd have to go off to the High Court anyway. When I looked at Section 413, it's to be enforced by the region under the normal mechanisms, but I didn't follow all the way through, but I was at a loss to think why the High Court on that one.
Yes.
Obviously, I haven't read far enough.
Yes, I'll have to go
if
back and refresh
back
my memory.
Yeah. Anyway, High Court's not what's intended.
No, in fact, the enforcement, is the enforcement mechanism intended to be different from the enforcement mechanism that currently exists?
Tom de Pulsmaker again, that's correct. Enforcement would now be undertaken by council.
And so looking at the policy, ensuring some clarity in that regard might be helpful.
Within the policy, I don't immediately see a need to have that in the policy, personally.
Perhaps the matter, again, could be clarified by making it abundantly clear what the effect of the regime that is sought to be replicated is.
Yes. I think that's a better way to approach it. Just reflecting on what has been said a few minutes ago as well, I did notice that Ms. King raised some concerns as well as to how the effect might be interpreted by consents officers and whether there is a risk that actually instead of bringing down the priorities, applicants might propose a totally different mechanism, which is a residual flow, which would not do that because priorities are exercised, you know, sporadically in most cases, whereas residual flows, they are there all the time. And so that avoids that risk as well, in my opinion.
Ms. Dicey, did you have anything to add just a moment ago? No. All right, I wonder whether we might move on now to the controlled activity rule. So I'm looking at Roman 8, so it's the blue shaded box. Which, as I understand it, is the entry condition into the controlled activity pathway. Now, I'm interested to explore what it was you have in mind at a principled level in terms of what needs to go into the application and then test that as against the wording that's actually been recommended. So, the first part of that exercise, what is it that you're anticipating should be offered as a condition by way of entry condition to the controlled activity pathway?
Tom the pulse marker. That was something that we discussed during the expert conferencing. Coming up with a proposed condition and what specifically needs to come into that or needs to be captured by the conditions for dominant and subservient ones was again explored with input from Mr. Wilson, Ms. King and Mr. Leslie.
Thank you. any additional explanations as to what was intended to be required?
To mentor, a recognition of the whether a consent holder was a had a dominant or subservient position in terms of priority.
Sally Dicey, yeah, I agree with Mr. Ensor that the application would include the list of priorities relevant to that permanent to that permit. Sorry. And then also the application form would include a draft condition which an applicant could simply tick. So the intent behind that thinking was really to, again, to focus on efficiency, make it as simple as possible for both the applicant and the council.
And so, thinking back to the discussion around the policy, is this condition driving at the ability of one permit holder to have a priority over another, or alternatively a subservient, we'll come back to that word, a subservient permit holder agreeing that somebody else has the right to restrict their take? That's what this is about, it's that aspect of the priority regime.
Sally Dicey, that's correct.
So when we think about that being the purpose, and then we go back to the rules that, or the drafting of the rule, I just want to see whether that outcome is captured. Because at the moment, as I read the condition, towards the end it says that the application replicates the right of priority expressed in the deemed permit. Now, when you think about the definition that's been inserted in terms of the right of priority, is that intending to refer to the matters covered in the definition or a subset of those matters?
Sally Dicey, can I just clarify what you're focused on there? Are you meaning the words expressed on the expiring deemed permit, whether that limits it as opposed to the wording used in the definition? Is that what you're...
No, just starting with the words used in the definition, so the right of priority.
Perhaps another way of putting that is to say that the definition has a number of elements. For example, the definition says it's a right allowing the right which enables you to instruct another person to cease or reduce their take. So there's two of the elements. And so did you intend both those elements to be captured under the entry condition, or actually only just some of those elements to be captured under the entry condition? Is that what you were getting at? Yeah.
Tom the Pulsemaker. So when you refer... Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
When you are you referring to... when you refer to elements, cease or... reduce.
Mm-hmm. That's the example. There's other elements. Yeah.
That was discussed.
Oh no, sorry. So, Mr. Moore's question is this. Mr. Moore said when he looks at the last part of the entry condition that says that replicates the right of priority expressed in the deemed permit, and then you go to the definition, and you go, oh, okay, what's the right of a priority? How is it defined? It has a number of elements, two of which are cease or reduce. And we know that your evidence is you're not intending to capture reduce. So what then are we to take out of the words an application that replicates the right of priority expressed in the deemed permit, when we already know and you don't want to do that?
It is not a matter of not wanting to do it. We initially had reduce in there, but reduce poses significant issues in terms of enforceability, and also practically, if it is required to reduce taking, then for clarity reasons, it would be best that on the notice provided to the subservient permit holder, the dominant permit holder would state by how much. Now, that changes all the time because flows change all the time as well.
So with that in mind, you don't, in fact, want to replicate the right of priority in the definition, do you?
No.
No. So that's what Mr. Moore is getting at. And so if that's the case, is this entry condition clear?
It is really the order between the permit holders that we want to bring over, not all the other aspects.
Yeah, and so it's about actually letting go, if you like, letting go of the legislation and saying what it is that you want to do.
Murray Brass, and this again is difficult in terms of how you structure it, but the effect of the ability to require someone to reduce would, in a practical sense, be carried over, because if you're the subservient consent holder, you don't want to be told to switch off completely if you can avoid that. So in a practical sense, if reducing your take to half will mean there's enough water at the dominant intake point that the condition is not triggered, then by reducing, you have operated the condition in that way, but we weren't able to come up with some wording that would carry that across in an RMA enforceable context. So it's, in my view, it's left sitting there as something that people are able to operate themselves, in effect, but not as part of the wording of the condition because of the enforcement difficulties that Mr. Pelsmakers referred to.
When you look at the text at the in the chapeau of the right of priority definition, might that wording actually be closer to the key issue that might need to be reflected in the definition, in the policy? So this is the right allowing the holder of a permit to instruct another permit holder or holders to cease or reduce their takes when there's insufficient water to take to meet the authorised allocation. Is that really the key issue here? That's the trigger for bringing these things or recreating these things.
The definition is very much focused, Tom the Pelsmacher, the definition is very much focused though on the dominant permit holder. So I think it is important that where you have a subservient one that does not hold priority as a dominant one over another one, that it is also reflected in the policy and any other wording in the plan change framework. So simply transferring the language, I think, might not work. But it's definitely food for thought.
Sally Dicey, I think that is the core aspect of the right of priority, the ability of one person to tell another one to turn off or turn down, or picking up on what my colleague just said, or to have to turn down or turn off. That is the core aspect of it, yes.
Now, coming back to the wording in the entry condition, it refers there to replicating or replicates the right of priority expressed in the deemed permit. Now, when you look at the definition of right of priority, is it the intention that you are replicating that right as that right is set out within subparagraphs A through to D? So are you replicating in the context of A, for example, the provisions of the Water and Soil Conservation Amendment Act?
No, you're not replicating it exactly as it existed, but the definition is focused on explaining what a right of priority is.
So what is it that is to be replicated when you look at the entry condition?
Tim Ensor, it's the right of allowing the holder of a permit. Blah, blah, blah. The A, B, C, and D, as I understand it, is to explain the authorisation.
So, I'm probably paraphrasing here. What you're seeking to do is to replicate the effect of one permit holder having an opportunity to require another permit holder to cease taking water. That's the element that is sought to be replicated.
Tim Ensor is correct.
Or I should perhaps also say, or the flip side of that in terms of a subservient permit holder. So then when you think about this entry condition and you think about the policy as informing perhaps what the entry condition is about, again, there's perhaps a need to better capture precisely what it is that is needing to be replicated in terms of this right.
Sally Dicey, I'll pick up the mic, see if anybody else is going to. Yes, I think that's probably fair.
I've noticed you're all... Nobody's prepared to look at me anymore. At least I pick on them.
I agree. I think we've had a reasonably lengthy discussion about this, and there's enough uncertainty in the room that it's worth looking at that again in the context of what we've been discussing around the chapeau of the definition, probably as a starting point.
Sally Dicey, and I'll just add to that as well. And I think partly this reflects our journey with acknowledging that the rights of priority finally expire, but wanting to capture them in a point of time and carry them over. But yes, it needs to be acknowledged that they're not exactly as they were back in the day. Yep.
So,
Murray Brass, and just as part of that, part of the reasoning behind that goes back to my earlier comment about transferring from a private property right arrangement, which is where mining privileges started life, to a resource management consideration. And so that, certainly in my mind, has been a large driver for looking for wording, the effect of, as opposed to simply one person's right over another person. But I'm open to being convinced otherwise on the legalities of those terms.
So you're still worried that if you just use direct language, I've got a right to tell you, not to tell you off, I've got a right, thinking about children now, I've got a right to turn you, to tell you to cease, sounds like private property. And so that's, you know, a language that we don't want to go in that direction. So is that what the issue is there?
That was certainly my concern.
Yeah.
But if that language can be used in a way which doesn't create that issue, then I'm certainly open to using that language.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
We use the word the ability.
Tom de Balsemaker, I had similar concerns to Mr. Brass. Also, we actually often went back to the definition during the expert conferencing. The reason why we got so far away from it is because there are a few elements in there that are problematic. We talked about reduce and cease. The reference to there being insufficient water as well was considered to be a hurdle from compliance point of view as well. So that's why we kind of strayed away from it. I think we need to be mindful if we try to go back that we're still keeping those discussions in the back of our mind.
Go back where, sorry?
Sorry?
When you say if we go back, you mean back in the direction of what?
Back in the direction of using more language that is consistent with what's in the definition.
You mean Section 13 of the Water and Soil Conservation Act?
No, basically tell, you know, how we have the definition here in PC7, where it's basically one water user telling another one to stop seizing, stop taking water.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was going to move on to the matter of control in relation to the controlled activity. So the new matter of control BA. And I'm interested to understand what was intended in relation to this matter of control. So when I read the wording there, any condition that replicates the effect of the exercise of the right of priority, that's starting to introduce a further concept in terms of the exercise of the right of priority. And I'm interested to understand what it was the group was intending to capture by referencing the effect of the exercise of the right of priority.
Tim Ensel, perhaps I could start off with the exercise being a reference to the mechanics, I suppose, of the process, the notice, and the process around it.
Is there a distinction that you're intentionally drawing between the effect of a right of priority and the effect of the exercise of the right of priority?
I don't recall there being a clear distinction. There was replication of the effect of the right of priority and then bringing in this process element being the process around exercising that priority.
Was the intention to have Ms. King and her team have to inquire as to whether or not the priority was actually being exercised?
Tim Ensel, no, that wasn't the intention.
So
I'm assuming you're meaning as part of the application process.
Ms. King, when you read this matter of control, is it clear to you whether you should be inquiring as to the effect of the exercise or simply the effect of the priority?
Alexander King, so reading that, it looks as though I should be assessing the exercise of priority. So then undertaking an assessment of whether that has ever been done. And then replicating the effect if it had been done.
And having heard that response, planners collectively, does that highlight perhaps a need to refine the drafting of this matter of control?
Sally Dicey, I do remember some discussion about this with Ms. King at the expert conferencing. And the intent wasn't for consents officers to have to assess things such as whether they had been exercised and what effect that might have on species, etc. So if that's, we perhaps didn't get as far as we could have, should have with that one, so it could be refined, I think.
Tim Ensor, yes, if that is how it may be interpreted, then I agree with Ms. Dicey. The intention is that the consents officer can see that there's a condition that replicates that mechanism and not go further than that.
And is that, again, capturing what is at the heart of this issue, that one consent holder can ask or has the ability to ask another consent holder to cease taking?
Tim Ensor, yes, and the inverse, yes.
So again, if you're tracking down through the policy, through to the entry condition into the matter of control that's being reserved, if that direct thread can be connected through those provisions, that would perhaps better reflect what it is you collectively had in mind.
Tom the pulse marker, correct.
I should say it's very easy for me to ask the questions to actually do the drafting. I appreciate there are some complexities, so please don't take my questions as criticism. I'm really trying to make sure that the drafting is reflecting what it was that you had in mind when you were putting the words together. Now, in terms of the drafting, the same issues would presumably apply because the same phrase is used on the restricted discretionary activity. And so and perhaps you could just confirm it's the same wording in terms of the matter of discretion that's used.
Tom de Postmugger, that's correct.
I'm going to move. Your Honour, what time did you want to take the lunch adjournment today?
1 o'clock? I mean, I don't mind. Do you want to break now if you're thinking? Well, I thought you could perhaps leave off with your questions and then maybe the planners could think about it over lunch, but then that's to deprive planners of lunch. But
In terms of where I'm heading next, I do want to explore the definition a little further to see just how that is intended to be captured, so perhaps I might do
I'm
that.
I'm quite happy for you to continue to one, unless you need to take a break.
Your Honour, if I could just interrupt just a moment. Coming back to the issue of Mr. Ensor, he needs to depart this afternoon on a plane in order to get to Rotorua. South Island airports are closing. Apparently snow is coming for Dunedin. Mm-hmm. I'm really anxious to ensure that he does actually make his plane this afternoon.
Then we're definitely continuing.
It's a request that we continue a little bit longer.
Yeah, sure.
Even than 1 o'clock, if Your Honour would be able to do that.
Yep.
In other words, to take a later lunch break and enable us to push on a bit further. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Right, I want to explore the definition a little further. And I want to just understand how some of these concepts are intended to be replicated or not. And I want to start with the distinction that's drawn between ceasing or reducing a rate of take. And I want to just understand in the first instance whether the recommendation from the group collectively, or perhaps there might be some alternative viewpoints, is for both elements to be replicated, so both the ability to cease taking and the ability to require a reduction of take.
Murray Brass. My recollection of the attempt there was to reflect what existing rights of priority state, and that wording does have the cease or reduce. And what this is perhaps highlighted is that we may need to think about how that is carried over if the new version is not exactly the same, how we captured that. But I think it's important that those words be there in terms of the definition of what an existing right of priority is, because in the wording used, that is the wording used.
So you're saying it's still important somewhere to capture what the existing rights are, as opposed to looking forward and what we're replicating, or not replicating, but looking forward in terms of what we want to achieve for on a replacement consent.
Yes, so understanding what the existing right is, from which we then work out how we best replace or replicate that. So this was about a statement of fact about an existing right of priority on an existing deemed permit or mining privilege.
Is it important to have your reflection of what you say is the existing right when it's already there in the Act, in the RMA? To be fair, what you got here, I don't think actually is accurate if it's meant to reflect the existing right. It's introducing new language which doesn't appear either in the RMA or in the Water and Soil Conservation Act. So if that's what your intention was, it's just simply, you know, looking back historically, why do we need to do that? Or is that what, firstly, is that what your intention was?
That was my understanding of the intention, and I'm open to any other views.
Tim Ensel, yes, that was my understanding as well. In the policies and rules, we're referring to an entity or the effect of an entity, and the intention was to reflect that historical.
I want to stay on the theme of whether the concept of a reduction of take is intended to be brought through. And I'm interested to understand from the planners first how it is they envisage a notice might be given which captures a reduction.
Tom de Pulsmaker, I previously discussed it when when we had expert conferencing, we had the benefit of people from the regulatory team being there. And having the reference to reduction on a notice, it needs to say how much reduction is required. And that is problematic in a dynamic system.
Murray Brass, just to expand on that, I think perhaps the underlying problem is that the existing rights of priority operate based on the dominant holder's rights. So it's the amount of water that's available at their intake, and does that give them enough to meet their allocation? The problem in an RMA perspective is that in issuing a notice to the subservient holder, that needs to specify what they need to do, which needs to be at their point of operation, not at the dominance. And it's that mismatch between the two, which operated as a private property right, if you like, originally, but is now difficult to carry across to implement that in an RMA perspective, where you're telling one person what to do, but it's actually entirely driven by what's happening at a different point.
I'm interested in anyone with any practical experience who's able to assist by explaining how this current concept of reductions actually plays out. So, Ms. Dicey, sorry to pick on you, but you seem the most likely candidate. In your experience, if a dominant permit holder wants to call priority on a subservient holder and they only require a reduction in take, how does it actually work?
I haven't actually got personal experience of this, so sorry, Sally Dicey. But my understanding is that it's often just a phone call or a text saying, I'm not getting enough order, can you turn down, please? And it might be, I don't know whether it's an amount, and I don't know whether a time specified, and I would imagine that it would vary significantly. There may be a reasonable understanding of what's happening at somebody else's point of take, but often, the flip side, I also know of situations where water users think they know what's happening at someone else's point of take, and actually, through kind of the last however many years of flow metering, those assumptions haven't always proved to be correct. So I imagine it varies considerably, and it is, as Mr. Brass alluded to, it's more difficult in the RMA context. Well, you may not, as the dominant priority holder, actually know for sure how much somebody else may need to turn down by to get you the water that you're seeking, taking into account the complex hydrology that we can have on a lot of these trips. So there may be flow losses between the points of take.
So just big picture, in terms of how you see this working, if this type of an approach is adopted, is it still the view that there would be informal arrangements as between water users will be the predominant way in which the water sharing is occurring, but that the driver for that is the regulatory backstop of the ability to give a notice?
Sally Dicey, yes, that's very much so how I see this working. I think that people will largely carry on as they have and will be loath to get the council involved, will be loath to actually have to follow a lot of the notice provisions, and that will be a backstop, a last resort, really. And for that reason, that's kind of one of the reasons with the joint witness statement, I noted the concern that I had about it, we're not actually replicating if we don't include the ability to instruct a reduction rather than simply a cease. But I agree with Mr. Brass's comments earlier that that this is the backstop, the power to issue a proper notice, to go to the regional council and to ask another permit holder to cease their take altogether, is a sufficient backstop that in the vast majority of cases people will be communicating with their neighbours to ask them to turn down or turn off, as the case may be, without even issuing the formal notice and involving the regional council. And so the backstop of the regulatory involvement, enforcement, will be sufficient in most cases, I think, in vast majority of cases, for people to comply.
Murray Brass, and just part of what has sort of informed that understanding is that from around the table, we don't have anybody who's aware of a case where a dispute over priority under the existing regime has gone to a court of competent jurisdiction, I think is the old wording, or to council to enforce. So in practice, they have been addressed between the parties, but the fact that there is a stick being held behind the back is what's given that the power to operate.
This is important. You've, Mr. DePaltimore, you're not aware of any, I still think it's a regional council enforcement action because I still haven't caught up with your High Court power. But anyway, you're not aware of any action being taken in any court of competent jurisdiction to enforce the rights under a deemed priority?
Not personally aware of any.
Ms King, are you aware of any?
No.
Mr Wilson?
No.
Okay. Nothing? Mr Leslie, thank you.
Sean here. The best I can think of, I don't know if it was related to priorities or not, but the best I can think of is situations where the regional council has gone out in the field to investigate complaints because there's no water left in the stream rather than there's not enough water left in the stream, i.e. where an upstream neighbour's drying out the stream.
And those complaints of no water left in the stream, is that by an irrigator or could that be by a member of the public?
I'm not sure. Really in a position to speak to the details. I'm just operating off a general recollection.
Now, staying with the definition, if I might, there's reference to the phrase insufficient water, and my understanding is that that phrase has caused some questions to be asked in the context of potential compliance. So it would be helpful if you could explain why that phrase has been used and where it has come from. So what was the purpose of including it in this part of the definition?
Tom de Pelsenmaker, I believe the phrase insufficient water comes from the Water and Soil Conservation Amendment Act.
So in a sense, all you were seeking to do, and I think you gave this answer to the court, was pull through the existing meanings in terms of
correct.
This right of priority. You weren't seeking to draw a distinction between that underlying legislation and that which is in the definition.
Correct.
Now, at the end of the definition, there's reference to not creating, again, the phrase, a right of priority for the purposes of section 124, capital B2. I'm interested just to understand why it was considered appropriate to include that carve-out.
I, Tom de Pelsenmaker, I was reading over the documents yesterday evening, and it is actually referred to in the note 3, so there's duplication, so in my view that can be taken out of the definition. So it is replicated under the heading 10A.3 rules, note 3.
The mischief that you were seeking to avoid by referring to the section 128 capital B, 124 capital B rather.
I have to I rely on my memory, but in the Act there is provision made for applicants applying to be basically lined up in a priority sense, first in, first served. So it was to avoid any doubt around that. And I think that section specifically makes reference to the word priority.
As I read, I'm curious as to the language used as between the note and the definition. The note refers to or says that the right of priority in the entry condition, Roman 8, it should be, does not refer to a right of priority for the purposes of 124B2, whereas the definition notes that it does not create a right of priority. And what I was wanting to understand is whether those were two different things that were being addressed.
No, they're one and the same. In all honesty, I think the discrepancy between the two sentences is probably a reflection of the time constraints we were working under. And I agree there is opportunity to fine-tune the wording in the note as well, because it does not make reference to the RDA rule as well. So
is what you were seeking to capture here, or to refer to, that you were not intending to create a right of priority, for
yes.
the next time round that consents get considered?
Yeah.
So if that was to be retained as a note instead of, you know, as part of the definition, the word create should be read instead of refer.
Yes, I think it's more appropriate. Yep.
The final question I had about the definition was hopefully a very swift drafting issue. When I look at subparagraph A, I wonder whether the first word of that subparagraph, which is also A, is in the wrong place, and whether that should actually follow the word by in the chapeau.
Sorry, where are you, Mr. Moore?
Right, the definition.
Oh, definition.
Subparagraph
A.
Yeah. The first word A, so a current.
Oh, a current.
Just wonder whether the A actually should follow the by in the chapeau.
Tom de Postmarker, that's correct.
Your Honour, that I think concludes the questions I had about the drafting, but mm-hmm. I did then want to go back and then explore the further part of the JWS where the technical witnesses were providing their views on some of that drafting.
By way of cross-examination?
No, just having them explain, sort of, just in terms of the joint witness statement itself, there are a couple of sections, but including from paragraph 20, where the consenting and compliance issues arising from carryover of priorities. I just wanted to explore that section a little further.
Sure.
If that's a good time to press pause, it would suit.
I think we're pressing on.
Oh,
actually.
We are pressing on. Yep. Oh, you want to continue? Well, yes, we can
Whilst
continue.
Whilst the airports are open.
Yes, yes. Very well. I shall be swift.
Is the other possibility that you save your questions and the court asks the questions of the planners? I'm just wondering if that might actually be a more efficient use of the time. I'm assuming that.
Oh, I see. If the balance of the questions for Mr. Moore can be taken later, and he doesn't need planners to be reflecting on that.
Yes, and that might.
Paragraph 20 to 25. Is that what you were thinking?
I'd be content.
Sorry?
Yes, my questions are focused for the three technical
witnesses. Okay, so in that case, if we could just part those up and we'll come back to those and we'll just continue on with questions from...
Thank you, Your Honour.
Yes, that Council may have. So, who wants to go first? Ms. Irving.
I'm not sure that the matters that I've been noting are helpfully explored with the panel today. They might be better explored specifically with Ms. King and Mr. Cummings, and also with Mr. De Pelsenmaker when he does his evidence in reply.
Okay, all right. Nobody else?
Well, I do have a brief line of questioning for the panel, but it doesn't require Mr. Ensor to be here. So
I require Mr. Ensor to be here and listen to everything that has to be said about priorities, with the exception of the enforcement and consenting regime,
yes.
So we can carve them out from that.
I don't have any questions for the panel about the drafting of what they've produced. My only, what I want to do is explore briefly the implications of the do-nothing option, which...
I think you should ask Mr. Enzel about that too. Have Mr. Enzel present for that question.
Yes. All right. Well, it's 3 or 4 minutes worth.
Yeah, sure.
In that case, do you want me to do that now, Mark?
Yeah.
Could we go to the operative regional plan as on Common Bundle page 59? If we can keep going, that's 56. Page 59. All right, so I'm going to ask a couple of questions about the implications of policy 5.4.3 that you can see on the screen, which is for the transcript on Common Bundle page 59. And my questions are intended to explore the implications of what's been described as the do-nothing option. And what I understand the do-nothing option to be is not to include the carryover of rights of priority under Plan Change 7. And so the first question I have for the panel is, when you have the chance to read Policy 5.4.3, do you agree with me that this creates, for decision-making under the operative regional plan, a requirement to consider the effects of granting consents on the existing priority regime? And I don't mind who wants to answer that question for me.
Tom de Pulsmaker. Yes, I recognise the policy. We actually, it was raised during the expert conferencing as well, as a probably creating a link, because the difficulty that we have is that Chapter 10 is a standalone chapter.
Yes.
When it comes to renewals of, replacement consents. That is a policy that would, or that could be taken into account when you look at new consents to take water.
New consents, did you just say?
Sorry, consents for water takes that were not previously authorised.
Yes. Does anybody else wish to address the point?
Murray Brass, and I think it's probably just confirming what Mr. De Pulsmaker's referred to in terms of takes that are not presently authorised, is that that provision, as I understand it, would not come into play for controlled activities under Plan Change 7.
Yes. And so my next question, does anybody else from the panel wish to address that before I ask my next question? No? So my question that follows, follows from Mr. Brass's answer and Mr. De Pulsmaker's answer is that if Chapter 10 doesn't include a policy similar in its effect to 5.4.3, does it follow that Plan Change 7 would have the effect of having a different water allocation policy framework than the operative regional plan?
Have a different... different what?
Water allocation policy framework.
Just let me think about that.
Tom de Pulsmaker, the effect of going back to the do nothing scenario would be that this element from the operative planning framework is not replicated.
And so the concern about avoiding effects on existing lawful priorities, if that's not carried over into Chapter 10 through Plan Change 7, Does that then constitute a change of policy around water allocation? If decisions under Plan Change 7 can't take into account Policy 5.4.3? Ms King.
Alexandra King. Would that depend on the rule that it's being applied under the operative plan? From my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that if you are applying under the RDA rules in the plan, you wouldn't necessarily look to this policy anyway?
All right. Jared, can we go to Common Bundle page 183, please? And hopefully when we arrive at 183, we might find the list of matters for discretion under Rule 12.1.4.8. Yes, keep scrolling up, please, Jared. Here we go. We're back. Can we look at the clause which is Roman numerals 17? Can you scroll down to that? Pause there. Now, just give the panel a moment to read clause 17. Ms King, is that the provision that you had in mind?
Yes, I think then you could assess that policy, and then I agree that it potentially might change.
Yes. So is it the case that if what Plan Change 7 is trying to do is to carry over the status quo for a period of time, that we need some kind of mechanism equivalent to what's in the operative regional plan to enable priorities to be observed? Answer it if you wish, Ms. King.
Sally Dicey, I'm holding the mic so I'll talk. Yes, would be the simple answer.
Murray Brass, just with the distinction that the existing policy is a matter which Council has discretion over how it applies, the proposed controlled activity anyway would be something that just applies automatically. So there's a shade of difference in how they apply that matter.
Yes, thank you. But so returning to where I started, if Plan Change 7 doesn't have a mechanism of that kind, would that actually represent a change in the way that water allocation decisions are made through the consent process? Because we're missing something that the operative regional plan already deals with.
Tom de Pelsmacher, it changes the way to which the decisions are made, water allocation decisions are made. Whether that means a change in actual effect on the ground, potentially, or in some at least. Yep.
And is that, since you've got the microphone in your hand, Mr. De Pelsmacher, is that change deliberate, or is it simply an accident of omission?
It was not a deliberate decision to exclude priorities. What I can say about that is that we have not monitored the exercise of priorities, so we didn't have any good information to say they were actually being exercised.
Okay.
Were your questions, Mr. Page, directed at, you know, the general proposition, towards the general proposition that one should, that as a consent authority, always be considering what is the effect on another water user, was it, of allowing the exercise of a permit? So whether the taking of water under a water permit should be restricted to allow the exercise of another water permit. Is that a matter of general proposition, or is that a matter that you're directing more towards the presence or absence of some policy mechanism for priorities? I wasn't sure where you were going. Well, because certainly the policy that sits above it's looking, it has two arms, the existing lawful users, and it talks about priorities in the second part. Yeah.
Well, what I'm doing, ma'am, is exploring the implications of the do-nothing option, since that's
okay,
still
so
live.
Now at do-nothing, and so priorities are not even...
But
don't have a look at,
what I'm trying to explore with the panel is whether the do-nothing option is actually a change of policy, because the operative plan does address effects on priorities and contains a mechanism to deal with that, but Plan Change 7 does not.
So, I'm sorry, you've just lost me a little bit. Is this with a view to saying... look, what you've got here is too difficult. Let's go with something that's already written up in the operative plan, and you've referred this to a policy and a matter of discretion. Is that what this is about?
No. What I'm trying to tease out is that do nothing seems to be the easy option.
Yeah. I don't know. But, yeah, okay.
But what I'm doing is attempting to draw attention to the implications of the easy option as actually representing a change in water allocation policy that hasn't been deliberately crafted into Plan Change 7. It's just an accident of not dealing with the priority issue.
Well, is it an issue for any party that if you have a do-nothing option. Now, I do know that we've got witnesses who are saying that. But but I don't understand that any party present before the court today is advocating a do-nothing option because that may have an impact on users' reliability and may also have an impact on users' reliability and an incident or a secondary impact on the environment, particularly in relation to Galaxis. I'm missing something here. I don't know what I'm missing. Sorry.
Well, the only reason why I'm pursuing this is because the council has a dual personality at the moment. We've got Mr. De Pelsmaker who favours one outcome, and we've got the consents administration team who, for their own reasons, favour another. And I don't know what the council's position is right at the moment, so I'm exploring the implications of either outcome.
Okay. Okay, so the do nothing, so there's nothing in this plan change. Why is that? And so the proposition is that, therefore, that's a change in policy in terms of managing the effects on other water users of a replacement consent.
Yes, because policy 543 sits in the operative plan to address the effects of granting decision consents on priorities.
Yeah, Plan Change 7.
And Plan Change 7 does not.
Okay.
That's it.
All right.
So I don't have any further questions on that subject.
Okay. Clicky. It is an interesting question, though, in terms of what is the council's position at this hearing, eh? So I should have laughed, but it's like, where is your client? But you are the client, so, you know, I actually have you in my sights, Mr. Moore. But we've got to... So nobody pretends that any of this is really is easy. And if there's problems with the drafting, then the drafting, if you like, is of huge value, because then what it indicates is, well, it's not as simple as trying to replicate stuff that's already in a statute. So that's the value. It's actually, well, work that one up, see how it goes. Oh, there's some problems here. And so maybe then, as I've reflected before, we need to let go of some of that. I mean, I understand that the priority system is really well understood, but if this is to be carried forward, and this is not an indication of the court's thinking at all, but this is the solution that you've presented, so I'm, for my part, I'm interested to see can it be carried forward or not. So anyway, Mr. Moore has covered a number of things that I wanted to talk to you about. You know, what is the effect that is to be replicated? Whether replicated is in fact a useful term, I suspect it's not, because you're not you're neither replicating what is actually in the legislation, nor you're replicating what's in your definition. So that's going to be problematic. And it, quite apart from the issue of whether or not flows are to be reduced, and I think your advice is not, but that, but not to worry about not replicating the effect of the current rights of priority by not recording the reduction of flows. Mr. Brass, your evidence is, in practice, this behaviour is likely to emerge or to continue to be the case, because people would reduce in order to remain on longer without actually there being a direction which is to cease. So you're reflecting on what is current behaviour within the... Now, in terms of the exercise of those consents, and I didn't hear anyone had any issue with that.
That is correct.
Yep. And I think the important point raised by Ms. Dicey is that quite apart from the value of all of this is not the value in all of this is because it's quite a coercive mechanism that then stands behind what are existing relationships within catchments and subcatchments to, on an informal basis, manage flows as between existing permit holders. And so that's what this value is. It's not, you don't imagine that people are going to be ringing up the council and saying, well, we want enforcement actions or prosecutions. The other thing that seemed to me, and you're all nodding, so that seems to be correct, that's how you see the mechanism. And the other thing that struck me as being a little odd, but I suspect I know your answer to this, is that one of the things to be replicated was the maximum authorised allocation as authorised by one of four things, and I'm thinking, no, it's not. Well, maybe you intended that. You're not looking to, under the right of priority definition, you're not looking, am I right in thinking you are not looking to replicate the full take as currently authorised under a deemed permit?
That is correct.
Yeah. No.
And, yeah, I think we probably need to reflect on how that works within the definition.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. if it even survives. Because your maximum authorised allocation, which you're driving at, is actually now, which is under the schedule. It's not as authorised by these permits at all. Do you all agree with that? Okay. Now, as I understand it, but I might be mistaken in this, I don't think your lawyers or counsel who've made submissions in relation to deemed permits and rights of priority are saying that those authorisations that you refer to in the definition under subparagraph A and B, so these are authorisations under the Water and Soil Conservation Act and the Amending Act, continue to exist, because they ceased on enactment of the RMA under Section 366. So that's as I understand the law, and maybe your lawyers are going to tell me that that's wrong, but I didn't think they took any issue with that. So these those rights ceased under Section 366. Everybody agree with that? Right? and all the planners are indicating that they agreed with that. So if that's the case, then there's no utility, no value in referring to A and B in the definition. Was interested in what you meant by in subparagraph C to the rights of priority. So here you've got a deemed permit that is issued under section 413, so this probably just reflects my ignorance or lack of knowledge about the consenting regime or permitting regime. Did those permits for everybody get reissued under section 413? Is that the case or not the case? I don't know. You think so? Because I couldn't see anything under section 413 which would have indicated that.
The short answer is no. My understanding is that we essentially have three different types of deemed permits, which is why I think part of the reason why there's the reference to A, B and C. So we have the mining privileges which have come through to us from the 1800s and have continued right through and are still valid under the RMA. We have the notified uses which were issued in the 70s and 80s, some of which replaced mining privileges and went on to become deemed permits. And then we have a swath of consents that were issued under from the 90s through to the early 2000s, where there was a, as I understand it, there was a bit of uncertainty over the implications of Section 413. And so people were coming in with their mining privileges and their notified uses, which had an expiry date on them that met the requirement under Section 413, but they were getting them issued as new permits, which were deemed to be deemed permits under Section 413.
Oh, just something, if it's... Oh, sorry, Mr. Brass.
Murray Brass, and my recollection of the distinction there between issued and granted was that where they were issued, because they were still a deemed privilege or a deemed permit, that council had no discretion. It was simply an accounting exercise to reflect on paper the existing situation, hence the use of the term issued, whereas granted implies council has some discretion in the matter.
Well, if it may be that the definition doesn't survive or something else comes in its place, but I'm just wondering, with that explanation in mind, is subparagraph C actually required if what you've got is a valid permit? If it's valid, it's valid. And the idea of that you're issuing something will get people like myself going, oh, I wonder what that's all about. And it's not really helpful if it's valid and it's a deemed permit. It's probably captured by your definition for valid permit. What do you think? Everybody's happy. So ABC's gone, perhaps. Yeah, because we're just dealing with valid permit. D. No, I thought that was really interesting. What is D? Resource consent granted in substitution of a deemed permit or mining privilege. What is that? Is that small burn or is that something else?
Small burn and possibly something else.
Okay, so at least small burn.
But it would be captured as well, I think, by the definition of a valid permit.
Ah, well, if that's the case, because I don't know that we should have bespoke provisions for small burn, who probably doesn't even know that their consent has been discussed at this hearing. If it's valid and everybody agrees that, and I do not recall the details of small burn, except that something happened, and instead of a new permit issuing a resource, there seemed to be another deemed permit. Whether that was right or wrong to do that, if it's valid and there's no issue.
It is just a safety net. D is just a safety net to capture any irregularities that might have occurred in
the past. You see, I sat there and I thought, does that actually cover all reconsented deemed permits to date, like 75% on the tidy catchment? No.
No, it is an exemption.
And if it could be interpreted to, if you like, allow deemed permits back, which is the very thing you don't want, you've already said you don't want to happen, then maybe you need to think about that a little bit more in terms of wording, or think about actually does the valid permit definition actually cover this, right? The other question that I have is the word regime, and I wondered what you meant by regime and whether the word regime was intended to colour the defined term right of priority regime. I thought that was interesting because, yeah, is it meant to be colouring the right of priority, which on its face, at its minimum rather, is at least the ability to be able to tell somebody to cease taking? Was it meant to colour that? Well, by colour I mean, does it mean to introduce practices that have emerged in some catchments in response to those rights, including the entering into of formal and informal flow sharing agreements? That's a regime. Is it meant to capture that?
Sally, I see no. From my perspective, it definitely wasn't meant to capture that.
All right. Could it?
I don't think it would, but if you've thought of that, then possibly yes.
I did. Yeah, no, I did. Because it's a reflection back of the evidence that you gave from Mr. Moore's questions. It's actually, what you're hoping you'll achieve here is giving regulatory force to a coercive instrument, which in practice will be observed by people within the catchment, and it would be exceptional and at the moment unheard of that councils asked to enforce it. So it may well give rise to, you know, it may well be the basis upon which these other informal flow sharing arrangements are entered into, but that may be what happens in practice, but it's not what's intended to be secured in this provision. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, this again, it might be my ignorance, but it was just something that, how you phrase something at paragraph 6 of the JWS, and you say there that the wording of the controlled activity rule was intended to exclude council officers assessing whether or not a proposed condition was appropriate. And I was thinking, can you do that? As a consent authority, couldn't the consent authority... Okay, so it's restricted its attention to the matter of control, but surely it could say, well, that's a wonky condition. I'm not talking about this, I'm talking generally.
Sally Dicey, I don't think you can actually prevent a consent officer from doing that through a matter of control.
Okay, and that would certainly be the case of the RDA. So anything, if you can't, is there anything arising out of that statement but not allow processing officers to assess whether the condition's appropriate? Because I reckon they probably could. But I might be wrong.
Sally Dicey, again, the intent behind that was to try and limit a consent officer saying, well, there's this regime of priorities in this catchment. Now I need to go and understand whether that the resultant flow regime has an impact on a Galaxa population and whether I should tinker with that or not. So that was what we were driving at. So really wanting to try and limit through the wording that occurring.
So limit through the wording any inquiry beyond, if you like, the rights as between permit holders. Would that be fair? Yeah. And that's perhaps what the policy was, that the effect of the policy, if you like, that Mr. Page was referring to earlier, because that's looking at rights as between permit holders. All right. One thing that did bother me about excluding the restriction of the ability to tell your neighbour to start to reduce, and again, it may be in practice that's what folk will do anyway, but I was worried whether, if it's just straight out secession, that you could get to very low flows more quickly than you would otherwise under a regime that says, look, people, we all ought to start to reduce, it's in our best interests. And if that was the case, could you, under a secession condition, alter not only reliability as between consent holders, but the flow in the river, to the detriment of the in-stream value? So,
Sally Dicey, I think by the time priority is even a question in someone's mind in terms of calling a priority, the rate of abstraction has already reduced. So that's typical of takes from tributaries in Otago, that through the summer months people aren't able to access their maximum rate of take and they're dropping anyways. And so, say if you're just talking about two permit holders, both of them would be on vastly reduced rates of take anyways.
You mean before you get to a secession?
Yes.
Why is that? Is that just like common sense and good neighbourly behaviour?
That's my understanding. That there is a level of kind of working together and that flow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you don't think that the secession, you think in practice, it may be in theory that you'll get to absolute low flows in terms of the permit with the dominant permit or the superior interest, but in practice people will be on a regime where folk are gradually reducing.
Yes, I think that is correct.
Does everyone
in a lot
agree
of circumstances. With, yeah? I mean, again, there's always such big variety of how people action these things. So that's right. Yeah.
Undesirable.
But I do. That's right. But I do think the flows in summer are self-limiting in their nature, that they do drop off and people do respond to that. And a lot of the time people's systems are designed for that. Historically they'd access water in spring and put a bigger amount of water on their paddocks in spring and then anticipate that reduction. And I think one of the examples you heard was Mr. Weir in the Pigburn, and he'd only used it 3 times in 10 years, and he was down to stock water. And so he was judicious in terms of how he was using that on his neighbours. But again, yes, that's only one example. Yeah.
Anybody got anything else they'd like to add to that?
Tom de Pulsmacher. Going through the expert conferencing, I think probably all of us thought about that. Like, we can only go so far in trying to maintaining those flow regimes. We've had some evidence in the court as well. I think it was Mr. Hickey who said the status quo in a dynamic system is never going to be a status quo, because you'll have delay effects. There will always be changes. Ultimately, we're kind of relying on people's behaviours, and those can change. So I think any option can only go so far.
Yeah, and so the key element is that it is a dynamic dynamic system. Mr. Brass.
Murray Brass, and also for me, was being in a situation where there are uncertainties, there are variabilities, the plan change is intended to carry over until a new plan comes in, so it's really that 80-20 rule, or viewing things with a risk management lens. So accepting that, you know, we're not going to be able to craft a perfect solution, And if we could craft a perfect solution, you can implement it without requiring a whole lot more effort and activity on people's parts than this plan change is supposed to be triggering. So it's finding that right balance.
Okay. And so it was interesting that, Mr. De Palsmaker, you raised evidence from Mr. Hickey, because Mr. I'm pretty well sure it was Mr. Hickey who said, look, the rights of priority and maintaining the rights of priority is not a foolproof way for saving those galaxies, because within a dynamic system, he said, my recollection was anyway, was that there's more than more going on than the exercise of the rights of priority. You had to be flows were changing within Otago as a consequence of improvements to irrigation efficiency. You're moving from border dike wild irrigation to spray irrigation, and then the subsequent throughput via groundwater or surface water into the rivers, and that was also impacting galaxids. Does everyone recall that? And so, yeah, sorry, Mr. Brass.
Yes, sorry, I would just add to that that even if we could lock in exactly the existing situation, for some species of galaxid, they are in decline under that existing situation. Mm. So, say, even if we could lock something in, that does not automatically protect those species or those populations.
Mm. So that's realistically, the outcome for some species may be that they remain threatened or continue to
The risk remains.
The risk remains. So if they're threatened now, they'll be threatened under this system and they may indeed become extinct. Is that what you're saying?
I would cross my fingers and hope not extinct, but yep. Certainly loss of extirpation of local populations.
Loss of what, sorry?
Of local populations.
Yeah.
So for a number of those galaxies, they're a small number of discrete and separate populations remaining. Mm. So that each one of those populations that gets lost doesn't make the population go extinct, but does increase the risk to the overall population.
Mm. So part of, in order for this transitional plan is not, you're recommending not only transition the right to be able to turn, tell another to turn off, so that's one right. But it's also trying to hold true. It's also important in terms of the outcomes for galaxids that there be no further improvement, which is enabled through a plan in terms of efficient irrigation systems. Is that what you're saying? That no more land conversions occur without a better understanding of what the interface between land and water.
Murray Brass here again. That would certainly be the case in terms of the long term, in terms of Plan Change 7 and restrictions on increasing irrigation area. I guess that's really operating as a proxy in terms of trying to manage the impacts on in-stream flows. So again, it's probably a risk management approach as opposed to something that's a fully formed regime.
Mm. And does changing land use also have an impact or potential impact on the flow regime and therefore on the population of galaxids?
Murray Brass again. Yes, if that changes the way that an existing consent is operated, and it's quite possible for a consent to stay within its existing limits and conditions, but be operated in a different way or utilised more fully. And while it's not really a matter for Plan Change 7 directly, also for the potential for any downstream effects in terms of runoff discharge, etc., from changes in land use. So again, as a risk management approach, minimising the amount of things that are changing in the system does at least help minimise the risk
Right. And so that's how you conceptualise this plan change. What it is, it's a risk management. It adopts a risk management approach in terms of minimising any further changes within the environment, both the land environment and water environment, which may then have a deleterious effect on the existing populations of galaxids. Is that fair?
Yes, in terms of galaxids, that's certainly my understanding. Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody take a different view in terms of what this plan change is endeavouring to achieve?
Tom de Posmark, no, I agree with Mr. Brass.
Okay. Ms. Denzel, you do too? Yep. And Ms. Dicey?
Sally Dicey, in terms of trying not to worsen effects on these populations, yes, but yeah, the do nothing, the push pause, and allow continuing decline is the kind of background concern for me. So I'm not sure if it's achieved that. So just yeah.
And by that answer, I take it that you're not looking at option A, but what you're saying is that Plan Change 7 is a do-nothing approach, even where rights and priorities, or at least the right to tell your neighbour to cease taking, is brought forward in an effective mechanism.
Yeah, that's right. I was referring more to Plan Change 7 in an overarching sense.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
But ask if Mr. Rensel could be excused. This is the point where he really needs to do a runner. If he's going to make the plane this afternoon.
Well, what's the weather forecast like? I have questions.
That you would like Mr. Rensel to answer?
Yes, I would. Minister says this is important, and I need to know how this is being landed, so I have questions.
I accept that.
We can find out what the weather forecast is like and whether Dunedin's still open. Where are you flying to? Auckland? Is Auckland still open? I don't think Auckland's impacted by snow. Yep. Do we have any reports that Dunedin's going to close because of snow?
Not at this stage. They've just closed their ATR flights, the small plane, but the jets are still going.
Jets are still going. Mm-hmm.
The difficulty for Mr. Rensel is that he has to get to Rotorua after that, so he needs to drive.
So the issue is actually Mr. Rensel needs to get the Rotorua hearing.
Yes.
Not the issue of Dunedin Airport closing.
Well, Dunedin has closed to the ATR flights, yes. so he's limited to the big planes, which will fly direct to Auckland.
Okay.
With Christchurch closed, that does narrow the options.
When's the last plane out for a jet plane?
The flight tonight at 17:00.
We can investigate that, Your Honour.
Pardon?
We can certainly investigate that. If Mr. Rensel is staying for that flight, then it might be helpful for the court to take the adjournment, because I'm well aware that it's past the normal time.
I'm quite happy if everybody's happy to continue and finish the court's questions. Oh, you need a break?
Need a break, yes. All right. I understand. Mm.
All right, well, we'll take a break then. Thank you.
Thank you.
All rise.